Okay, so today's lecture is called Symmetry and Supersymmetry, and most of the lecture will be about classical mechanics and classical field theory and the Lagrangian formalism, and in that formalism how you handle symmetries and then, of course, supersymmetries. Let me just start by mentioning the quantum picture. So as we said yesterday, when you have a quantum theory, we want to think that we have a complex Hilbert space, which represents the states, or we might even think of the complex Hilbert space that represents the one-particle states. But in any case, we have this complex Hilbert space, which is a graded space. The H-naught, the even part, represents the bosonic states, and the H-1, the fermionic states. And a symmetry is really a unitary operator on this Hilbert space. Now, there's a basic unitary operator which tells you the time evolution of states given by the exponential of the Hamiltonian. And so a symmetry is usually said to be something that a unitary operator that commutes with the Hamiltonian. Now, in any case, if we look at infinitesimal symmetries, an infinitesimal unitary operator would be a skew adjoint operator. Physicists are more accustomed to working with self-adjoint operators. But in any case, the self-adjoint or skew-adjoint operators can be divided into two parts depending on, you can grade them, in other words, depending on whether they preserve this splitting, they map H-naught to H-naught and H1 to H1, or if they reverse the splitting. And so the symmetries, the infinitesimal symmetries then, are graded into even and odd according to whether they preserve or reverse. And the ones which reverse, which map bosons to fermions and fermions to bosons, are what you might call supersymmetries. So in the quantum picture, again, it's an algebraic sort of notion, which is very familiar mathematically, that we can, once we have a graded vector space, then the endomorphisms of the vector space, that space is also graded. If we have a relativistic theory, we want to think of the whole Poincaré group being represented here. And the ordinary Poincaré group is represented by symmetries which preserve the grading. They map bosons to bosons and fermions to fermions. And in a relativistic theory, which is supersymmetric, there's an extension of the Poincaré group, which is then a super Lie group. Or if we think of the infinitesimal Poincaré symmetries, it'll be a super Lie algebra. And it will also have elements which map the even to the odd and the odd to the even. And so they'll fit together with the Poincaré symmetries. And that structure we'll discuss in the next lecture. But for today, what I want to really focus on is the classical picture, and maybe at the end we'll have time to say something about how you quantize to get the symmetries in the quantum picture. Now, as a preliminary to the lecture, so I don't have to interrupt, let me do a few sort of differential geometric preliminaries. And I just want to remind you of two differential geometric things and then say one thing about signs, which I omitted to say yesterday. So very briefly, the first thing I want to remind you is that supposing that we have a vector bundle with a connection over a manifold, then we have an extension of the Derome complex where I take sections of E. So think of those as functions on M with values in E. And the connection is a map to one forms with values in E. So that's the connection itself. And now we can extend that to map to two forms with values in E, and so on. So we get a sort of sequence of maps like this. It's not a complex in general. And in fact, the square of this operator is multiplication by the curvature. Okay. So that's the standard way to think about curvature in terms of vector bundles. Second fact is that supposing that we have a map from M into some manifold X, and let's suppose that we have a connection on X, which means on the tangent bundle. So this is now an intrinsic connection on the tangent bundle of X. Then the differential of this map I can think of as a one-form. It maps tangent vectors on M to tangent vectors on X. So in other words, it's a one-form on M with values in the pullback of the tangent bundle. Okay, so it's a one-form with values in the pullback of the tangent bundle. And now, since I have a connection on Tx, and of course, therefore, on the pullback, I can apply this operator here. And so I can apply this, which is now a two-form on M with values in the pullback tangent bundle. And this is, in fact, the pullback of the torsion of the connection delta. So if we're dealing with a Riemannian manifold and its Levi-Civita connection, such an expression vanishes. Okay, so I didn't want to interrupt later to have to remind you of that. And it seemed useful to do that here. The convention, the sign convention, which I neglected to mention yesterday in superalgebra, is the following. That supposing that we have a graded vector space, and let's choose a basis. Let's say EI is a basis of W naught, so the index I runs over some indices, and let's call E alpha. So I'm just distinguishing by not the E's, but by the type of index. I hope that won't cause confusion. Okay, let me call it F alpha, the basis of the odd space. And now we have dual bases of the dual spaces, and then F alpha, basis of the dual space. Okay, so these are just bases and they're dual bases. And now we want to work with the algebraic model of differential forms, which means we want to look at the exterior algebra of the dual space. So the exterior algebra of the dual space means that we have wedge products of these E upper I's and F upper alphas. And you see, if we have an element omega in here, then this has sort of 2 degrees. So we might write it has a parity and it has a cohomological degree. So this is the parity, and this is the cohomological degree. So if I just have an even vector space, this W naught, and I start taking wedge products, then I just count. If I'm in wedge P, we say that that has, if I'm in wedge C, we say that has cohomological degree C. Okay, so that's in the usual case. And then in addition, I have that these E's have parity 0, they're even, and the F's have parity 1, which is odd. And so now, when I multiply two such forms and I commute them, then by the sign rule, I should get a sign. And the question is, what sign do I get? So there are two possibilities here. One possibility is to consider a total degree, which is the sum of these, and use that in the sign rule. So in other words, the sign would be P plus C times P prime plus C prime. The other possibility is to consider it the parity and cohomological degree separately, and put the factor PP prime plus CC prime. Okay. Now, both conventions are consistent. They just lead to different signs in your computation. So you just have to choose once and for all which convention you want. And this is the convention which I'm going to use. And so very explicitly, this means that EI wedge EJ is minus EJ wedge EI. That's the usual rule in the exterior algebra for the even elements. It means that EI wedge F alpha is minus F alpha wedge EI. And that's the one which is different under the two sign conventions. So EI has cohomological degree 1 and parity 0. F alpha has cohomological degree 1 and parity 1. So under the other convention, F is even because its total degree is 2. And so these two would commute. But under this convention, the parities don't give you a sign, but the cohomological degrees give you the sign. And then under either convention, F alpha wedge F beta is equal to F beta wedge F alpha. Okay? So there's an explicit choice of convention there. There's one more sign convention which will come up, which is when we pair a vector with the dual vector to get a scalar, we have to decide which one to write on the left and which one to write on the right. Now, I won't make a universal convention and tell you that every time I see vector spaces, which one's the dual of the other, because we have the double dual, and that's confusing. But I will say that when we do geometry and we pair a tangent vector with a one-form, we'll write the tangent vector on the left and the one-form on the right. So in other words, we will not write a one-form evaluated on the tangent vector, but rather we'll write the contraction of a one-form of a tangent vector into a one-form. Okay, so if omega and xc were odd, that would lead to a different sign. All right, so that's just some technicalities about signs. And pardon me? Well, okay. Yes. Well, if x is even, you'll also get 1. Yes. That's the definition of... Right, so this is the one I take as fundamental, and this one is defined by the sign rule in terms of this. The rule is that if we have something even, this is 1, and if we had an odd coordinate, this is also 1. This one. Well, okay. That's the convention. There's no sign convention in that. Yes, but you have to tell me how to pair the vector space with its dual. But in what order? Because when you have graded vector spaces, it matters which one I write on the left. You see, the double dual, the map to the double dual has a sign. Look, we'll talk about it later. I'm not going to get stopped on that. Okay, so however we build up from the ground up, those are the conventions for calculating, and that will be good enough for this lecture. We can straighten out how you want to think of building from the ground up. Okay, so now the topic... As I say, the main topic is sort of classical Lagrangian field theory. And the main characters here are M, which we'll think of as a space-time. And here, typically, we'll take M to be Minkowski space. In fact, in these lectures, I'll always think of M as being Minkowski space. In mechanics, it's really the case n equals 1. So this is just the reals, which is time. So this is for mechanics. And for today, I'm going to talk about the Lagrangian field theory in generality, meaning for fields in higher dimensions, but my examples will all be in mechanics so that the computations are simple and we can illustrate the basic ideas in a more familiar context. And then later in the week, we'll go beyond mechanics. But I'll do the general theory in that context. Now, in Euclidean field theory, and in context that differential geometers we're more used to, this would be, for example, might be Euclidean space, first of all. And second of all, would be allowed to be a curved Riemannian manifold. Of course, here, too, we could allow curved spaces, as in Dave Morrison's lectures. And also, we allow this to be a supermanifold. Allow M to be a supermanifold. In other words, in the sense discussed yesterday, we allow M to have odd functions, anti-commuting functions. So that's called a superspace, and we'll see that towards the end of the lecture. The other main character is F, which we'll call a space of fields. So the field theory is a field theory about some sort of fields, and this is some space of functions on the space-time. So we might think of it formally as sections of some fiber bundle, E over M. So for example, if I'm just talking about a scalar function, which means a map from M to the reals, this fiber bundle is just the trivial bundle M cross R. If I'm talking about a connection on some principal bundle, this fiber bundle is some bundle of affine spaces whose sections give me connections. But in any case, whatever fields you're talking about, we can just collect them all as being sections of some fiber bundles. And again, we allow E to be a supermanifold. So even if M is an ordinary manifold on Minkowski space, we allow our fields to have odd values, as we did yesterday. Okay. And I'm going to really just treat two main examples. So the main examples that we'll treat, as I say, are in mechanics. So the first one is a classical particle. So in both of these examples, M will just be the reals, will be time. And so we'll think of a particle moving in some space. And the classical particle, the field, is a map x from time into some space, x. And we'll allow x to be some Riemannian manifold. So not just the particle in flat space, but let's treat a particle in a Riemannian manifold. And the second example will be a super, what we might think of as a superparticle. And here we have two fields. One is, so this is the space of fields. So here the space of fields has two fields. One is our map as before. And the other one will be an odd field, psi. So this is a section of the pullback of the tangent bundle, but to be thought of as being odd, anti-commuting variable. So we'll introduce this symbol, this sort of capital pi, which means parity reversing. And so we want to think of that as being a section of the tangent bundle, but that's somehow an anti-commuting function. So the picture is that we have our Riemannian manifold, and we have our path. This is my path. X is a function of t. And in this story, we have the manifold. And now we also have this odd tangent bundle. So remember, we have to picture that as some sort of nilpotent cloud or fuzz or something. So the manifold really looks like we're still mapping into x, but we again have this odd direction, which we can only see if we introduce these auxiliary parameters I talked about last time, which I won't talk about really today. And our path is somehow in there. So this is x together with psi is somehow moving and allowed to move, probe, in this other direction. Okay. So what we're going to do is basically the calculus of variations. And in other words, we're going to write an action, a function on this space of fields, and try to look at the extreme points and so on. Now, there are lots of formalisms for doing the calculus of variations, and I'll give you the one that I prefer. So what we're going to do is, so we do calculus on the space of fields cross M. So we're going to work on this product space. And we're going to do calculus in the way that I know how to do calculus, the only way I know how to do calculus, really, which is with differential forms. So I'll write everything in terms of differential forms, in terms of the Durand D, in terms of integration, in terms of Lie derivative. I'll use the Cartan formula and all the beautiful formulas from calculus of differential forms we'll do on these function spaces. Now, one thing that is a refinement, really, but that I'll use anyway since it helps keep the notation a little bit simpler, is that we actually work with densities on M. So rather than differential forms, we work with densities, which are differential forms twisted by the orientation bundle. So I'll use a notation where omega 0, but with absolute values, denotes the space of densities. So these are densities. And a typical density in local coordinates will be some functions times, just a function times some density, some local density. I'll just write as dny, product of dy1 through dy0 through dyn minus 1. And we'll also use spaces, which I'll denote like so. And this will be really twisted differential forms. And so the expressions will look like f mu of y in local coordinates, d by dy mu times that density. Well, if this is an n-dimensional manifold, we can think of this as an n minus 1 form twisted by the orientation bundle. So if the manifold is oriented, meaning I've chosen an orientation. The reason to insist on densities is, well, I'll get tired of writing n and n minus 1. It's easier not to write the n. It's a little bit clearer, the grading that's involved. And the more fundamental reason is that when we look at the symmetries, if I can write it as a density, then the orientation reversing things are symmetries. We'll see in the last lecture, finally, an example where we'll break those symmetries by having something which is a differential form, and then the orientation reversing symmetries are not symmetries of the theory. So it's actually to see what the symmetries are that you would write it technically as densities. Now, in this lecture, when M is really the reals, instead of writing absolute DT all the time, I'll just write DT, but you could really think of it as a density. Okay. So we're going to work with the following double complex. So we'll work with the double complex where this is F and this is M. And we're looking at differential forms on F and then densities on M. So I use a notation something like this. So for example, something in here with a 0 here and a 0 here, something called L, what would this be? This is a function on the space of fields. And for each field, this gives me a density on the manifold M. Okay. So the differential in the F direction will be denoted delta. And the differential in the M direction is denoted D. So these are just the usual differentials, Cartan differentials. And the total differential, I'll denote capital D, as delta plus D. Okay. And notice that since D squared... No, because I'm thinking of it as differential form. So I write everything as a differential form, so the negative signs will take care of themselves.
Yeah, but D usually doesn't go much beyond zero. Right?
I mean, no, yeah, it doesn't go here, but sorry. Here I have minus 1, minus 2. Yeah, it goes there. So the complex stops at zero. I'm using that sort of... Right. And delta and D, delta and D anti-commute. Probably. Sorry, you're right. I'm so used to thinking of them this way. All right, maybe I'll try to draw it differently in the succeeding diagrams. Now, if you want to think of this, we can think of the evaluation map which takes a field across a point and just gives me E. So if I have a field and I have a point, this maps me to phi of Y. And if we think of the fields as being sections of some fiber bundle, that would be a point of E. And so then if I take coordinates on E or something, I'll generate functions on this space. And those are the basic functions in terms of which everything is written. But rather than write this evaluation map, we'll really just use the notation phi. So that's the sort of standard notation. And so now the basic ingredient in a field theory is what's called the Lagrangian. And we already saw that in the lectures yesterday. I mean, physicists write down this Lagrangian and then get everything from that. And these sorts of computations are the bread and butter of this sort of field theory. And that's what I just want to review quickly and then go on to the symmetries. So the Lagrangian is something precisely in here. It's where I put it here. This is a, okay, so you want me to draw the complex a little bit differently. So here's F, here's M, here's 0, minus 1, minus 2, 0, 1. And the Lagrangian is something in here. So that means that to every field, I have a density. And that's the thing which we integrate then to get the action. Densities are things we can integrate over M. So in example one, the Lagrangian will be the standard Lagrangian x dot of t squared dt. So the dot denotes d by dt, the time derivative. And this just says to take the norm squared of this is a tangent vector, take its norm squared. So that's now a function, which is a function both of t and x. That's a function on f cross m. And then we multiply by the canonical density dt. And as I said, I'm not going to write the absolute value. In the second case, the Lagrangian is this term plus another term, which involves the psi field, and it's the inner product of psi of t with the covariant derivative along x dot of t of psi of t. And this whole thing is multiplied by dt. Okay. So again, last lecture was to discuss the exact meaning of such a term and how we could get this term to be non-zero. Last time we thought of it in flat space and just wrote psi times psi dot. Here we have to write the covariant derivative. So remember, psi of t is really a tangent vector in the target, and therefore to differentiate it, I have to use the connection and use it, write it here. Now typically I won't... Well, on x. Yeah. So this is just the usual thing. We have a path. Yeah. Think that we have a tangent vector field along the path, and I'm differentiating it. The only thing is the tangent vector field is odd. But that doesn't matter, you see. So again, the point of view is that we're going to do ordinary differential geometry in these supermanifolds and just pretend that we have these directions. And I gave you the psychotherapy last time, how to think about that. Okay. So so this Lagrangian is exactly the kind of object I said, I believe. All right. Now, there's a second basic ingredient, which is usually derived from the Lagrangian. And usually I should say that the Lagrangian is local in the field. That's an important property that's there. I mean, in this sort of general terms I'm talking about, it's not necessarily relevant for all of it. But usually it's local in the field, and in fact, in good cases, it just depends on the first value of the field, which is, say, x of t, and the first derivative, which is the x dot. So these Lagrangians just depend on the values, say the psi and the x, and the first derivatives, x dot, and that derivative. We could also write Lagrangians depending on higher jets. Now, in the case when the Lagrangian depends on the first derivative, there are some nice things that happen, most of which I won't tell you. But one of the things that happens is that the second ingredient is canonically determined in terms of the first. But in any case, we need the second ingredient, which we might call the variational, for lack of a better word, variational one form, which is called gamma. And this is an element of omega 1 minus 1. So in other words, it's a one form on the space of fields, and it's a twisted n minus 1 form on the space-time. So in terms of my chart here, gamma lives here. Okay. Now this gamma is the thing that we get, really, by integration by parts. And we work with the total sort of Lagrangian, which is script L, which is L plus gamma. Okay. So this thing has now mixed degree. And it's convenient to write formulas. And the defining property of gamma is that gamma satisfies the property that if I look at the total derivative of L, and I look at its one zero component, that this is linear over functions. So I'm going to explain what that means just in a calculation. So again, this derivative dl, 1, 0, lives there. So it gets a contribution from d of gamma and delta of L. So it's the total differential applied there. And this is just the standard computation, which you know and love, which is the following computation. So let's do it in the first example. And we'll just compute delta L, the variation of L. So, well, okay, so how do I...
There's no 2 minus 1 component?
No, there definitely is that component. I'm just saying that there's a...
you just said that component. Okay.
Right. It's just a condition on that component.
Okay.
Yeah. And so let me just show you that this is just a fancy way of saying the computation that you're all familiar with, which is the integration by parts when you vary the Lagrangian. I should have said, by the way, that the action S of a field phi is just the integral over M of L of phi. So this should be thought of as just an ordinary function on the space of fields. It's the thing I get by integrating. But we'll never need this action in the sort of formalism we're doing. We're always going to be working just locally on M, and so we'll never need to consider this integral. But if you're doing the calculus of variations, you think of really finding extreme points for this function. That's how you work. So really, I'm going to do the kinds of computations, but we'll never deal directly with that integral. We'll just do local calculus on F cross M. So for example, if I just differentiate that function, applying the rules of calculus, the Leibniz rule, and so on, you see I have to vary x dot. I won't write the t's. Inner product x dot, and then wedge dt, except that x dot is now a section of the tangent bundle. And so to differentiate it, I need to use the connection. So we'll write it in that way. So this is really a sort of standard notation that we use in other contexts when we have to differentiate sections of vector bundles. And with forms, we use this sort of notation. Okay. Now, we can write that as the derivative of dx, x dot, like so. Because what is dx? Dx is x dot dt. Right? And the order of the terms is to make the signs come out right. Now, this is something which isn't linear. You see, the calculus of variations argument is to say that for all variations of x, I want to find the equation of motion, which sets this equal to 0. But here we have a variation of x, but then it's differentiated. In other words, these operators commute. So this is minus d delta of delta x, x dot. Okay. Now I've used something there. So the alert student will notice that I've used what? I've used the fact that that connection is torsion-free. That was one of the preliminaries that I told you in commuting those operators. That's actually the statement that the Riemannian connection is torsion-free. And what I want to do is rewrite this by integration by parts as delta x times something. And then that something is the equation of motion. And that's the usual argument in the calculus of variations. So how do we rewrite this as delta of x times something? Well, this is minus d of delta x, x dot. So if I differentiate this, I first get this term. And then I get another term. I have to move the d past here, so I'm going to pick up a sign. So the d and the delta are operators which are even parity, but they're odd cohomological degree. And so you pick up a sign when you commute. Anyway, you get a minus delta x, and then we get, I guess, d delta x dot. Okay, so we can write this as minus d gamma minus delta x, say delta x dot dt, okay, where this form gamma is equal to plus x dot delta x. Okay. So that's just the Leibniz rule, nothing else. A little bit about connections. And so from this, we first of all read off the term we get, the exact differential we get by integrating by parts. That's the thing which is this variational one form. So in mechanics, that's the thing which is PDQ. Right? That's the PDQ term. And notice it has the property that if I take delta L plus d gamma, which is what this thing is, I should have written that delta L plus d gamma, you see that thing is delta x times something. There's no delta x dot. That's what it means to be linear over functions. I've gotten rid of the derivatives of the variations of the field by integration by parts. And that's what that condition is. And so the equation of motion is what you get by setting this term to 0. So in other words, when I integrate to get the action, the variation of the integral, well, this term vanishes because if we fix the endpoints or so, that's an exact term. And so then we get this. We say that vanishes for all delta x, and that's the usual argument that gives us the geodesic equation, like so. So this is the absolutely standard first variational principle of Riemannian geometry, or however we call it. Okay? So the definition of the space, let's say script M, of classical solutions is Well, it's the largest manifold so that DL 1, 0, in other words, that's this piece here, is equal to 0 on M cross M. So in other words, I look for the fields where this expression vanishes at all points of M. Okay. So physicists, so this M is a subspace of the space of fields, and physicists refer to this as on-shell. And somehow the whole space of fields is off-shell. And working on-shell means we impose the equations of motion. And when we impose the equations of motion, then you see that this component's actually equal to 0. So that part of the differential in this double complex of that total piece is equal to 0. So you're starting to build up a cycle. Okay, so that's just the basic, the very basic computation, and that's the setup in which I like to work. Now, okay. All right, so now we're going to have to speed up a little bit, but that gives you, in any case, the basic framework. Now let's do the computation, the same computation for this super thing. And just to get the conventions of the signs and so on right. So we just have to vary the second term because we already did the first term. So for example 2, we want to compute delta of the second term, which is 1 half psi delta x dot psi dt. And I can write that as delta of 1 half psi d delta psi, because d delta psi is just that covariant derivative times dt. And now we just apply the usual Leibniz rule. So we get 1 half. Now when I bring this inside, I have the covariant derivative. Okay. And then I get a plus sign. I'm commuting the delta past the psi. The delta is even parity. Psi is odd parity, so I don't get a sign from the parity. Delta has cohomological degree 1, but psi has cohomological degree 0. So again, I don't get a sign. So there's no sign in commuting those. And I get 1 half psi, and then the covariant derivative, psi. Now, the first term is totally OK. For the second term, I want to commute these two. And I can commute those two while they anti-commute. So I get a minus 1 half psi d delta delta, like so, psi. But now in commuting those, I have the first thing I reminded you of, which is the curvature. So the curvature appears when I commute these. And so I get another term, which is something like 1 half psi, the curvature evaluated on delta x dx psi. Okay, so that's the standard equation for the curvature. And now I write this term as a differential. So this is minus 1 half d of psi delta psi. So there's my exact differential. Again, I want to get rid of variations of the field which are differentiated. And then I have to compensate by putting on another term, which will be plus 1 half d delta psi, and then I have my curvature term. Now, to my curvature term, I want to bring out the delta x, and so I apply the symmetries of the curvature tensor, which tell me I can exchange these two arguments for these two arguments. And now, because of the symmetries there, I don't really have to worry about the order. And it turns out to be r psi psi dx. Okay. All right, so finally, this whole thing is d minus d of 1 half psi delta delta psi. Then this term and this term are the same, so I get plus delta psi with d delta psi, and then I get a plus delta x with 1 half r psi psi dx. So there we are. So really, this should have a wedge sign, I suppose.
What confused me here is that
Yes.
Well, for instance, the psi, I mean, R, you've put in the psi, which is in the
tangent bundle.
Tangent bundle, but the disparity change.
Yes. So that's why R of psi psi could be non-zero. For an even tangent vector, we know that the curvature is skew symmetric.
Yeah, right.
But because it's odd, that can be non-zero. So, you see, the reason I wrote this out like this, and hopefully you copied it, is that you should do the exercise of introducing these odd parameters, eta, that I defined last time.
Yeah.
So without any etas, this vanishes.